Good morning, and welcome to the Air Pollution Control District meeting of January 24th, 2024. If you would please rise and join me in the flag salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. May we have a roll call, please?
Director Arnold.
I'm here.
Director Bright.
Here.
Director Darris.
Here.
Director Gibson.
Here.
Director Hammond.
Here.
Director Marks.
Here.
Director Newton is absent. Director Ortiz Lake.
Here.
Director Paulding.
Here.
Director Pichon.
Here.
Director Seacrest is absent. And Director Wixom.
Here.
Thank you. Okay. We'll move on to our first Seacrest. Item. And that would be elections. So A1 is the election of board chair and vice chair for 2024. Does anybody want to speak to this item, or should we just, I mean, it's pretty apparent what we're doing here, but no?
Karen, yeah, I think I would like to propose that we put Jan Marks into this chair, actually as vice chair, 2 years out chair. I'd like to have her consider that, and if she's willing, I'd like to propose that.
Second.
I'm willing, since John has said he is not willing.
That's what seniority gets you.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, and I will nominate then our, I guess, I don't know if you need a nomination as vice chair.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'll nominate Jimmy Paulding for chair.
Second.
Okay, so can we take both of these at the same time, or we want to vote on them individually?
Yeah, I think we're going to want to revise the motion. You want separate votes? You can revise the motion to include both the vice chair and the chair nominations in second, or you can do two separate votes. It might be easier because we already kind of have a motion and a second for the vice chair. We could just do them out of order.
Madam
Chair? I was hoping we could do separate votes only because I had another nomination.
Oh.
And I have a reason, but I can go on for vice, but maybe we could do it in separate.
Okay, very good. So we'll do that then.
So I have a motion and a second to nominate Director Marks as the vice chair. First, motion was made by Director Hammond and seconded by Director Gibson. And then we also need to go to public comment before we take
yes,
a vote.
Yes, we do. Thank you. Well, first, I'm going to bring it here to the council.
Are we doing our chair, our vice chair first?
Yes.
And the chair second. Okay. So my thought here, I had another nomination, so I wasn't fast enough, John.
No problem.
But I was just hoping I was planning on nominating Mark Darris, and I was planning on nominating someone who's served on the board a long time but has never been vice chair. I know Jan's been through the ranks, and so have I, and many of us have, but so that was my plan. So we can go ahead and take the vote, and otherwise then I circle back and make my motion if necessary, or if I have an opportunity, I'll say it that way.
All right, then. We'll take the vote, please.
Do we want to open it for public comment before we take a vote?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Anyone in the public who cares to speak this item, please come forward. Seeing none, we'll close it and bring it back for a vote.
Okay, so the motion is to appoint Director Marks as the vice chair for 2024. Motion is made by Director Hammond, seconded by Director Gibson.
Yep, and under discussion, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Yeah, I would just like to repeat. So, Jan, you know this is not personal. I had this in my mind to do this, to bring in some new folks to the executive portion of this body. So for that reason, then, you'll know why I'm not supporting this motion.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Well, thank you. No, I'm willing to serve. I haven't ever been vice chair or chair of this board. You got me mixed up with SLOCOG and other things like that. So, okay.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me.
Okay.
Karen, question for Mark. Mark, you've been on 3 years, and are you planning on rerunning at this point? That's 2 years out, so are you going to be...
Yeah, I'll be on the ballot
okay.
next year.
For City Council
right.
at Atascadero, yes.
That's what I thought. Okay,
yeah.
So that should be able to serve.
So I'll be continuing,
sure.
yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're ready for a roll call, Madam Chair.
Any other comments? Okay.
Director Arnold.
No.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Darris.
I'm going to abstain since I was nominated. So.
Oh, you haven't been yet because I haven't made my motion yet.
Well, then I'll say no.
Okay. Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Newton is absent. Director Ortiz-Legg.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichon.
No.
Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
No.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
The vote passes 7-4.
Thank you. Okay, so now we'll move on to chair.
I'll nominate Supervisor Paulding to chair.
Thank you.
I believe we already had a motion to nominate Supervisor Paulding to the chair. The motion was made by Director Bright and seconded by Director Ortiz-Legg.
Yes.
Then let's vote it.
Well, let's have some discussion. Any questions? No. Public comment? Seeing none, we'll bring it back for a vote, please.
Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Darris.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichon.
Yes.
Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Ortiz-Legg.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
The vote is unanimous.
Marvelous. Thank you very much. And I'm going to hand this over to this very capable gentleman.
Sounds good. Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to serve as chair. And with that, we'll move on to item B1, and that's a presentation to our honorable past board chair for her leadership.
I think we have one thing before that.
We have the Basin Control Council.
That's right.
election.
Skipped over item A2. So we'll go to item A2, appointment of APC board representative and alternate to the South Central Coast Basin-wide Air Pollution Control Council. And Gary, did you have a presentation on this item, or you're just looking for us to make an appointment?
I don't have a presentation, but it's a pretty easy gig since we've gone to meetings at each office in the district. So we used to have to drive down to Santa Barbara and meet quarterly, and we discuss our commonalities of rules and different programs. And we do get a little state subvention funding for it, probably enough to cover it. So it's a good thing to do to get educated on what's going on in other districts and learn what they're doing, and kind of an organic way for board members to get ideas of things that they might want to put in our policies and programs. So I think it's very, very educational. And since it lasts about an hour and a half and you only have to drive to our office to Zoom on, and it's pretty quick.
So, thank you, Gary. And I certainly learned a lot when I was on that board. First, I'll take questions of the board, and then I'll go to public comment and then come back for board deliberations. Any questions on my right? Doesn't look like it. Looks like Director Hammond has his hand raised.
Yeah, Jimmy, thanks. So are the meetings up here now? Before, they were in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, we're doing three remote meetings so that the public, to avoid Brown Act, we publicize at the district office, and public from either district can go down there, and their representative is there as well. So here would just be at our office now.
Okay.
Great.
All right. Yeah, I've served on that too. It's very educational. I mean, it's good to share what's going on with other, you know, some districts in the area, that what they've had and what they're doing and what we're going to, you know, talk about as well. So it's a good collaboration there. So
it looks like Director Marks, did you have a question or a comment?
No, I have a nomination.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and go to public comment. Is there any public comment today? Looks like there are none. So with that, I will ask Ms. Marks to make a motion.
Yes, I'd like to nominate Kate Seacrest. I have to say I was in this position once, probably over 10 years ago. And air doesn't stay in one county, right? Air moves around. So learning about the basin, the air basin, is just very important.
And second.
Okay.
Got a motion and a second.
Kate has said.
Sure, yes.
She's willing. Okay, good.
Any board discussion? Okay, seeing a motion in a second, let's go to a roll call.
The motion is to nominate Director Seacrest to the SCCBCC Council for the calendar year 2024. Motion is made by Director Marks and seconded by Director Gibson. Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Darris.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Ortiz-Legg.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichon.
Yes.
Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Vote is unanimous.
Thank you, Director Seacrest, for stepping up for that. With that, we can move on to...
We do need to nominate an alternate.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me. Any nominations?
I'm willing to do the alternate if you'd so choose, because I live so close next to the office.
So moved.
Okay. We have a motion and a second.
Second.
If we can go to a roll call vote, please.
The motion is to nominate Director Ortiz-Legg as the alternate for the SCCBCC Council. Motion is made by Director Ortiz-Legg and seconded by Director Bright. Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Darris.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichon.
Yes.
Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Ortiz-Legg.
Yes.
Vote is unanimous.
Okay, with that, we'll move on to presentations. That's item B1, presentation to Mayor Karen Bright for her leadership as board chair in 2023. Gary, do you have a presentation?
We don't typically do a presentation, but we do say thank you. I think that Karen has done an excellent job during this time period. We had at least one very contentious meeting that she steered us through expertly, so... and always some difficult subject matters to deal with from time to time. So really appreciate the way that Karen handled the meetings, and we got through it unscathed. So much appreciated.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I would certainly echo those comments. And it looks like we have a certificate to present you with, and maybe we take a board photo, huh?
Oh, boy. Well, thank you. Very kind. Thank you very much. My reward is handed over.
Public comment on that item? Seeing none, any other board member comments before I move on? Okay, well, thank you again for your leadership.
Thank
much
you.
Appreciated. With that, we'll go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. And I'll take public comment. Any public comment on the consent agenda? Seeing none, turn it back to the board. Anybody would like to pull an item or any questions going to my right?
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Board Member Arnold.
So I just had a question on item C5, which is the independent audit of the district's financial statements. And I had two things. In the staff report, I had one public... member of the public just called saying that talked about a report being attached, and the report wasn't attached. I know that I guess all of us board members had a hard copy, so I hadn't really paid much attention to that. But in going back, is it just something I'm doing wrong on the computer, or was the report not attached for public view?
Yeah, the report has been part of the clerk's file since 2002, and we've never attached it, and I didn't even realize it until somebody brought it up today, but the same language has been there since 2002, so it's always been in the clerk's file. I've since directed staff to change that typo in one place where it says it's attached and the two other places okay. where it's in the clerk so file to change that.
People know where to go find it.
Yes. And
perfect.
My apologies.
Perfect. It's
something
okay.
that's been going on for over 20 years and you just... And then somebody reads it, and it's like, wow, we look so
yeah,
stupid.
Yeah, someone takes an interest, and then
yeah.
there it was.
And
so,
it's
and
all
I
my fault, because I reviewed
so.
The entire package, and I just read right through it. So
It was funny when on this phone call, I kept going to the item on my deal, right? And I'm saying, it's attached. And I'm just naturally thinking that person is not looking in the right place. So we went for a few rounds, like, look at your deal. I'm trying to walk...
Yeah.
Anyway, then in the end, it was me.
Much apologies on
no,
my
no,
part.
No, it's okay. And my second question is, inside the report, there was a letter, a smaller report, a letter, right? And on the second page of the letter, there's a part about misstatements about the district overstated accounts receivable and unearned revenue in the amount of $14,000-something and then $138,000-something, which is a bigger amount or more, you know, jumps out a little more. But can you just explain that? I didn't know how to answer that either.
We kind of had a disagreement with them on where that money should be posted on which fiscal year. And so it came in at year end and we posted it in the current year and they wanted it in the other year. So revenues are still the same, doesn't change anything. It's just which year that money was posted. So, you know, as the overall audit finding is, it's, you know, we're in great shape. But yes, procedurally, we changed some things. Yeah.
It makes it sound like.
Well, you know, when you're an auditor,
so I'm
you,
glad
you want to make sure that somebody doesn't come back and say you let something go by.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of there's no overstated accounts receivable in that.
There's no. It's just one year versus the other.
It's listed in another place, basically.
Yeah, you put right? it in the wrong year.
Okay. So it's there and.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. Those are all my questions.
Thank you, Supervisor Arnold. And it looks like Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indeed, I'm glad we got that squared away. What I look for, particularly in an audit, is the auditor's opinion on internal control. And I did notice in the staff report, it notes that there was one deficiency in internal control identified. I wonder if you could speak in some detail to that and how that's being corrected.
As far as I know, the internal deficiency is that posting. Isn't that correct? That's what we're talking about. That was the internal deficiency.
Well, the posting is the consequence
yes,
of
education.
What control is.
Right, yeah. So educational, educate the person who was accounting for it and posting it to
the
not.
The deficiency in internal control was a lack of knowledge of where that amount was supposed to be posted?
Correct.
Okay.
And so it's really, really very minor. My wife's, you know, worked for Price Waterhouse as an auditor for years beforehand, and she just, and most of the time you don't get that put on there.
I get it, but deficiency in internal control jumps off the page at me,
so that's why we need to
have your assurances and your financial staff's assurances that indeed
you can not only have that, we can bring the auditor from the county over to talk about it if you like.
Okay,
I mean it's really not it's not a very big deal. I mean, I guess if it was a large sum of money and somebody posted it there and we didn't have the money, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, if that happens again, we've already made a decision, you know, where to post it and taking that into account.
Okay.
So
okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's all this grant money that comes in at the last of the year.
Thank you, Gary. Any questions of board members on my left? It looks like Director Marks. You have a question?
Oh, this isn't a question. It's more of a comment.
Or comments.
Yeah, please. I just want to say that I'm very happy to see C7, that the APCD is going to be directing $336,000 to install fast chargers. And I think it's really great that we have it under local control rather than having it through a corporation, because we know the community, so thank you.
Any other questions or comments by members of the board? Would anybody like to make a motion?
So moved.
Second.
We've got a motion and a second. Can we get a roll call vote?
The second was Director Wixom, correct? Yeah. Motion is to approve consent agenda items A1 through A7. Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Deras.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
I'm sorry. Aye.
Thank you. Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Ortiz Lake.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichon.
Yes.
Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
With that, we'll move on to general public comment period. If there are any members of the public that would like to speak on items not on today's agenda, please come forward. Okay, seeing no public comment, we will go ahead and move on to the APCO report.
Okay, good morning again. Gary Willie, APCO. Just I'll make this kind of quick this morning. Our farmer program that we brought to your board in November, launched on December 4th, took all the funding in less than a week. We currently are overly subscribed. A lot of ag tractors want to be replaced right now. And we're working to identify future funding for that program. For now, the program is closed. We're not accepting applications because we have so many to backfill. And unfortunately, right now, given the state's budget situation, the farmer program for next year is not in the budget. It doesn't mean it won't come back, but it may not be the same form. They may, at the end of the month, the state is supposed to come out with their Climate Pollution Reduction Act grants, and they may put the money in there. So, but they're kind of quiet about it. Mm-hmm. But all kinds of stuff's going to be moving around here in the next few months. That's the distribution of the climate reduction grants. Climate pollution reduction grants go through. So we're hoping that goes. If not, we've got some other monies that we can go to the best projects in the farmer category to get those through. Wood stove replacement program. We're having a hard time spending that funding, which we knew would happen. The state took away our ability to go from wood to natural gas, and they want us to go from wood to wood with cleaner wood, or they want to go wood to electricity, so heat pumps. But we're hoping, we took the money, we're hoping that the state, where you're going to find this is going to be common throughout the state, that people can't spend the money with the program requirements they did. And they've kind of indicated they allow us to shift it to something else. Which would be good. So that remains to be seen, but likely we'll bring something back to this board with a modified wood smoke program down the way. Oceano Dunes, the December storm surged, reached our 48-acre Ford Dune project, but it just damaged the fencing. It didn't take out much, so it just kind of got into a little bit of it. The fencing has been repaired. This is expected. Those four dunes naturally get hit and come out and rebuild and get hit and come out as time goes by. There's been a question on from the public and to the hearing board on the reductions that we see at Mesa 2 versus our CDF site, and that the Mesa 2 site has shown less reduction, and that's kind of expected because the CDF site was so much higher to begin with. However, the good news is that, Alyssa, can you show that chart?
Sure. It's on your computer right now?
Yeah. If you can see.
You might need to zoom in on it.
That means I got to zoom in on it. There's no mouse. That's better. So we grabbed the 2023 data because we've seen this trends go. And this is our difference analysis. There's a lot of different ways we look at the dunes dust reductions. This happens to be one that takes in account, based on what Oso Flaco sees, our clean site monitor, what would we expect the other monitors to see based upon past data analysis. And you can see, if you look up from 2019, you can see how the percent reductions have gotten better and better. Mm-hmm. You can see the CDF site, and then you can see the Mesa 2 site. And what we saw last year was, you know, a very good reduction to Mesa 2. It had the highest percent increase. Still not going to get as much as CDF because CDF started out so much higher. And so CDF was our big trigger point. And now what we have is we have CDF approaching the reductions we've seen, higher percentage reduction we've seen at CDF. It's approaching that. And it should never get there because CDF was by far the worst location. It used to be 50% higher. It's still higher in general. It still has more violations, still some more work to go. But as you notice, these percentages are increasing, even though the last few years we didn't add acreage. We planted more plants, but we didn't take more acreage out of riding. The things are maturing, the dunes are growing, the plants are raising elevation, we're changing the topography. So it's actually working, and you know, we're very excited with these results. So with that, I think I'll just leave it there. We're going to be posting a fact sheet on this, and that's part of the fact sheet when it gets completed this week online for the public to look at and to share with our hearing board. We had the lighthouse prescribed burn happen on December 5th and 6th. That's always a really hard one, the way the eddy affects around that area. It always wants to bring some of the pollution into Avila area and into northern Pismo. However, it went pretty well. We got a lot of acreage burned, a little bit of smoke in town, but it's better than it going up uncontrolled. So that was really good. Backyard burn season opened on December 4th, so you've seen piles being burned around the county now that hopefully they're going straight up in the air. And so far, people are doing a pretty good job. Not a lot of burn complaints, not overriding like we've had in the years past, so feel good about that. On our retirements and reorganization, we conducted internal interviews for our succession plan reorganization last week. Not surprisingly, we promoted Alyssa Roslin to admin service officer, clerk of the board, Kristen Weeks to our fiscal administrative technician, and then Carl Tupper to a division manager position now, and trying to get him exposed to the different areas within the district as all the rest of us retire in the next couple of years. So anyway, we're excited to get going on that with a lot of work to do. And the last thing I'd like to talk about is our Section 218 agreement updates and impacts on how board stipends are paid. When the Social Security Administration found that we were paying under the county's EIN number, they made us switch and pay under our own, which is, you know, which is okay. But nobody did that initially when we broke off from the district. Since that happened, we've been going through this process. We're holding elections on the 31st. The staff gets to decide whether they participate in Social Security and all this other stuff. It's a very, very formal process. But part of that also requires that we treat the board members as basically employees. And so we're going to have to get your tax numbers from you and give you tax forms, and you'll have to pay, of course, Social Security wages on it because they want their 6.2%.
They want their cut.
Yeah. So anyway, so expect to see some more paperwork coming in order to get, and the County Board of Supervisors doesn't get the stipend. They don't have to worry about it. But the city members who are getting the stipend will have to fill out some paperwork. And sorry about that, but we tried to find a way around it. And with that, I'm through with the report.
Thank you, Gary. Any board member questions or comments on the APCO report? Seeing none, any public comment on the APCO report? Okay, seeing none, appreciate the update, Gary. We'll move on to board business items, starting with item D2, request to implement fiscal year 23-24 Slo County Clean Air Incentive Program.
You'll have Andy Metzger, our planning grants and monitoring manager.
Morning, Chair Bolden. There we go. Good morning, Chair Paulding and APC board members. I'm Andy Mutziger, division manager for the planning, monitoring, and grants sections of our district. So this board meeting, there was a strong grant presence. What you saw in consent, we had, as Gary mentioned, the wood smoke reduction program. We got some more funding for that. We'll see what happens with that, if we can spend it or if we'll have to bring it back to your board. We also had an early approval of year 7 of the Community Air Protection Program. And as Jan mentioned, we have the reallocation for the Cali VIP. So in addition to this, after this quick presentation, Megan is also going to be talking to you about our second round of our Clean Air Room program. So we're excited about that as well. The current board item that you were looking at today here is the implementation of this fiscal year's Clean Air Incentive Program. There we go. Okay, thank you. This slide provides a summary of our recommended project category allocations for this year's funding. This year's funding, we've got $967,265 of Carl Moyer and local DMV fees for emission reduction projects. Based on the demand that APCD staff has seen over the recent years, we recommend allocating these funds as this table shows, and I'll cover them in more detail in the next slides. Beyond these allocations, your board is also going to allocate about $99,000 for program administration for our program. And you're also approving updates to our request for proposals and authorizing the APCO to both enter into the necessary agreements and to reallocate the funds to other categories if uptake of these three categories is slow in the first 6 months. Next slide, please. Relative to last year's program, our proposal today would help spread out the funding to our off-road equipment replacement and repower program to more applicants by limiting the ability to get contracts for up to only $150,000 for combined funding for fleets that are under common ownership and control. We're also looking to shift our electric school bus or our school bus program to electric only. And we're not proposing any EV infrastructure funding because our community air protection program has that category well covered. Next slide, please. So our first recommendation here is for funding with the ag and construction equipment replacement as well as repowers and irrigation engine electrifications. We're proposing $400,000 of Carl Moyer funding, and this is in addition to the $1 million that we have already brought to your board this fiscal year for the farmer program. And as Gary mentioned, we have already locked up that $1 million, and we have applications in-house already that will suck up this $400,000 as well. The second category we're proposing is marine vessel repowers. And in recent years, we've repowered 5 vessels. And that's to help with early compliance with CARB's commercial harbor craft rule. This slide shows the Endeavor and the Black Pearl, which were funded with last year's funding. For this cycle, we're proposing $167,265 for additional repowers of the marine vessel program. Next slide. And this is the final category. We're looking to continue our push toward electric school buses. We've done 3 already. So this funding would allow us to do 2 more. And the school districts would then need to come in and get co-funding from other funding sources such as 3C Energy or CARB's HVIP program or the federal program, school bus program that just recently was accepting applications. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from members of the board? Anybody on my right? Seeing none. And Supervisor Ortiz-Lee.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew. About the Marine, I'm interested in how many applications do we have, or do we, that doesn't seem like very much money, $167,000. What can you do with that? Is that typically, and is there a demand yet?
Yeah.
Because I know the electrification piece is mm-hmm. coming to the Marine maritime industry and something that, so I'm just curious as how
that goes. I can say that so far we've had two interested applicants already contact us. So one of those applicants is already a prior award winner, and if they were to be able to secure some funds, it'd be about $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have funding for a second vessel.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, we'll see if we have additional funding or interest. But, you know, down the road, we will be looking to potentially reallocate funds if we need to.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to address that. We will,
ahead,
if there's a need, we will look around and see what we can get for funding because mm-hmm. we, you know, this is a tough thing for these small operators to do, and it's very expensive.
Yeah, and I would say, too, for the regular commercial fishermen, they do have some time. One fellow I was talking to, there's no need for him to repower until the end of 2030. So there will be some opportunities for the straight commercial fishermen. Mm-hmm. The others are under a much faster timeline.
Just to finish that, is there any funding that then goes to the electrification of the port itself? Because, I mean, there you have to go along with that at this point in time.
These are engines are repowers with the newest tier engines.
Correct.
And they're not electric yet. So I think that's coming down the line. But, yeah, we have a big infrastructure problem about, you know, having enough people to install and the distribution systems and the chargers. And so,
okay.
Yeah. It's a growing industry.
Yeah.
I would say at this moment, you know, the reality of electric boats, there are some opportunities out there, but it's pretty minimal at this mm-hmm. moment in time.
Yeah, I'm a little early on those things.
Yeah.
So. Thank you.
Sure.
Director Hammond, did you have a
question? Yeah, Andy. Thank you, Jimmy. Andy, on the school part of it, mm-hmm. the electrical, I mean, obviously there's a lot of infrastructure that has to go into the actual corporate yard that handles these buses, too.
Right.
Are school districts starting to get to that point where they want to try and electrify? And therefore, I mean, we're talking about two, and is it mm-hmm. the same districts that are kind of going after at this point, or are there other districts that are interested?
That's a good question. The three buses that we've done has been for Paso Robles School District, but there are other districts that are interested. I think the city, or San Luis Obispo, is interested. And I think, you know, with some turnover of some of the older school district fleet managers, we're seeing some more interest as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other? Oh, yes. Mr. Darris.
Yeah, I want to thank you. I want to follow up on John Hammond's questions. On the school buses, $400,000 isn't going to cover an entire bus, obviously. I think they're close to $1 million, if I'm not mistaken. If more than one school district is going to apply for funding, how much are you going to divide it up, or how is it distributed?
Good question. So actually, the buses are about $400,000. So we're proposing half of two school buses, and that's where the school district will need to go in and find matching funds from groups like 3C Energy. So that's
okay. Yeah, they're free to get money from outside grant recipients. As well, so.
And we've with the previous three buses that we've done, they've been able to partner with CARB, the HVIP program, to help fund the rest of it. So these are basically free electric school buses that these districts are getting.
Okay, I'm just surprised that it's $400,000. I know city buses are around $1 million.
Correct.
I don't know what the difference is, but I'm surprised to hear that it's 400. So.
Yeah, I think it's probably that the range is shorter on these school buses. You know, they're looking more around the 100-mile range is what they can do for a typical day. They can get by with that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Director Arnold.
So I just wanted to ask a question about the buses as well. Are the school districts mandated or is it something that's looming for them to have to make the full transition to electric buses?
Yeah,
Unfortunately, I don't have that particular answer myself. Our school bus expert, Vince, has retired. I'd be happy to look that up and see if I could find it.
And I can look it up later, too. But the reason I was even asking the question is with RTA, I mean, we've been grappling with some of the issues, and one being the heavy weights of the batteries and the electric buses that are almost making it impractical to make the switch over. They're more expensive, it sounds like. So I get the what you're saying, that the these other buses don't need the range, so they don't need to charge up as much. So maybe is it more practical? In other words, I guess where I'm struggling with this is I don't know if it's ready for prime time, and maybe especially with putting children on buses that maybe aren't performing as well, or with the weight, they've had to redesign some of the public buses to accommodate the weight of the batteries. So I was just wondering if...
Yeah, I can say that the electric school bus program has been going for some time, and there's been really good adoption, and there hasn't been much issues the buses.
Okay. That's what I'm asking.
These particular school buses.
Okay.
And one last thing I'll mention is that for this particular round of funding, we're using our local DMV fees. So the previous monies that we were working with was really our community air protection monies, which were isolated to certain pockets of our county. So these particular funds will be available to any of the school districts throughout the county.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments by members of the board? Okay, with that, we will ask for any public comment. Any public comment on this item? Seeing none, thank you, Andy, for a comprehensive presentation. We'll go ahead and move on to item D2, request to implement the Clean Air Rooms program.
Yeah, we need to.
Excuse me.
Sorry about that.
Little learning curve here as a new chair. Appreciate the latitude. Let's go back to item D2, and I will ask for a motion to approve this item.
Yeah.
Director Hammond.
Yeah, Jimmy, I'd like to go and make a authorized creation of a 2023-24 incentive program with $967,265 for grant projects and $99,188 for APC grant administration. And approve the budget adjustment request and allocate the grant project funded for off-road, marine power, and electric school bus projects.
I'd like to second that.
Okay, we've got a motion by Director Hammond and a second by Director Marks. Can I get a roll call vote?
Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Dieres.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Director Ortiz Blake.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pichong.
Yes.
Director Sechrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Vote is unanimous.
Okay, with that, let's go ahead and move on to item D2, request to implement Clean Air Rooms program.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Megan Field. I'm our public information officer and an air quality specialist here at the Air District. And today I am bringing our Clean Air Rooms program. As you remember, we did this program back in the spring of 2022. We learned a whole lot with that program, and we've been busy in the meantime trying to dedicate funding for this next round of the program. So a little bit about what I'll be going over today. I'll talk a little bit about particulate matter, how it affects our health. I'll also talk about the structure and the implementation of this next round of the program, and then talk a little bit about how we're going to get the word out and how the program will be funded and eligibility criteria. So I'll talk a little bit about particulate matter and our health. Obviously, as members of this board, you are no... it's not something new to hear about particulate matter, but we do have some new board members that were not here when we did the last program, so I'll kind of start from the beginning. Smoke, ash, and blowing dust all contain particulate matter, and smoke in particular is made up of PM2.5 and PM10, and it can be a nearly invisible pollutant. While these particles are harmful and can cause effects in all people, the most sensitive groups that are especially vulnerable are elderly, pregnant women, and those with pre-existing conditions. Both PM10 and PM2.5 can be inhaled. PM2.5 is more likely to lodge deeper in the lungs, while PM10 tends to be more on those upper, larger airways of the lung. Particles deposited can cause short-term irritation and even long-term effects. For short-term exposures, so we're talking 24-hour exposures, they have been associated with premature mortality, increased hospital admissions, heart and lung issues, chronic bronchitis, emergency room visits, and more. For long-term exposure, so months to years being exposed to these pollutants, it's been linked to premature death, particularly in people who have those chronic heart and lung diseases, and also reduced lung function in children. So wildfires in particular have become much more prevalent in our county and across California in the last decade, and the impacts are more sustained and not just isolated to the regions in which those fires are occurring. So we've been very lucky to not have any significant wildfires here locally. There have been a couple that have come close if it wasn't for those responders. But having said that, we've still been greatly impacted by fires that are outside of San Luis Obispo County. In 2020, for example, and even this past September, particulate matter across the county increased, largely driven from those wildfires that are outside of our county. So even prior to implementing our Clean Air Rooms program, something we've been doing is trying to help individuals create a cleaner air space in their home. Something we hear a lot when wildfires are present is, what can I do to protect my health, and how do I keep my indoor air quality clean? So during wildfire events and blowing dust events, the best protection really is to be staying indoors. And so developing that clean air room prior to wildfire smoke being in our sky is critical. We also recognize that in our county, there's many people that work outside and are required to keep working outside even when there are some air quality events going on. So the fact that we're able to provide them with something that will help them clean up their home and their air indoors when they are home is important. Air purifiers are a great addition to creating a cleaner living environment, and the Air Resources Board has lots of resources for people on different air purifiers and making sure people get ones that don't emit ozone and that they're good. While these devices can be purchased at local hardware stores or online, a small room device could cost around $100. That cost still can be prohibitive for many of the families here in our county. And or they just don't recognize that there's a problem and know that there's a need for them. And so we're happy at the opportunity to provide these free air purifiers for our community members who can't afford to outfit a clean air room in their home. Our clean air room really is about more than just giving out these free air purifiers to residents. It's about getting out information out in the community so that residents know there's an agency working to protect their health and that we can help them make those health-based decisions when the time comes. All right, so unlike our pilot program back in 2021, where we held two big, large pop-up events where people came and got their air purifiers directly from us, this year we're working on a program that will drop ship or direct ship these air purifiers right to the eligible residents' doors. Like I mentioned before, 2021 or 2022, it was really a boots on the ground, walking the streets of the community, trying to get the word out and get out these air purifiers to qualified applicants. So it was great. However, it was a very, very staff-intensive project. And so for the 2024 program, it allows us to more quickly get the air purifiers out without people having to wait in long lines, come down for an event, or potentially not have transportation to get there, which is something that was an issue the last time. Additionally, we have a reduced staff at the Air District, so this allows us to reduce our overhead. To qualify for this program, income-eligible applicants will need to submit an application online, which would include qualifying documents showing that they are a low-income household. They could provide documents such as proof of participation in a state or federal income assistance program, something like WIC or Section 8. Or they could provide their tax statement from the previous year showing that they qualify based on the number in their household and the SLO County low income rates. Once they apply, staff will work with the vendor that will be shipping them the device to get it right to their home. So a lot of work went into selecting the air purifier that we were going to use for this program and adjusting the program to allow residents to access this program with an online form. Pending your board approval of this program, we would enter into a contract with the selected purifier vendor, and we're hoping that we could launch this program probably mid-April. We did secure 10 bids through our RFP process, and the proposal that we are hoping to select was outstanding, and they have experience doing an identical program with the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. And so the list on the screen kind of encompasses a lot of the things we were looking for when we were trying to determine what air purifier would be best for the program. So as far as implementing this program, our goal is to purchase approximately 390 units to be direct shipped. Households that are sent an air purifier from the vendor will also be sent a packet of information from us, including multiple items that will all be bilingual to help them better understand air quality information, how to access that air quality information, locations they can purchase replacement filters for their devices, and suggestions on how to use their air purifiers. Like I mentioned, this program is more than just about giving away those air purifiers. It's about trying to educate our community members. So this is something else that we gave out the last time, are these stickers that you see on the screen. And these stickers are used, we'll send them to each person that gets a device. And it kind of walks them through how to use their air purifier, giving them a scale, the AQI scale, and showing them when they can turn on their air purifier so that they're not running them constantly, which will make the air purifiers last longer, make the replacements not have to be replaced as quickly. And so for the outreach with this program, it's really going to be a multilingual approach because we're going to be doing English, Spanish, and working with community members with Mixteco outreach. We're looking forward to working with agencies like the Diversity Coalition and the Promotores Collaborative to extend our outreach beyond what we typically do. In advance of this program, actually, we've already partnered with the Diversity Coalition to give them a few air purifiers that they can use as giveaways at some of the community events that they have coming up this spring. So they'll have them sitting at their booth with information about our program and use it as an enticement for people to sign up for more information. And I think I already mentioned it, but our target launch window is mid-April. We're working on finalizing some online forms that we haven't utilized on our website yet. So it'll allow people to fill out the form online and it come directly to us. But we do have backup options for people that might not have access to a computer or internet. We can mail paper copies of the forms. We also are going to have a computer kiosk set up in our office if people want to come, and we can help walk them through the process. So the funding for this program is slated at about $71,000, and we're using AB 617 community funding for this. And that $71,000 would cover the cost of purchasing all the device and support the implementation and the outreach of the program. So of that $71,000, $61,000 would be covering the air purifiers, those 390 air purifiers we're hoping to purchase. And our goal is to get all of these purchased and done within this fiscal year. So our staff recommendation for you is to authorize the creation of the 2024 Clean Air Rooms program for our designated low-income households across Slo County and approve the budget adjustment request that was included with this item. Also authorize the air pollution control officer to develop guidelines and enter into any contracts or agreements necessary to implement this program. And so at this time, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate the presentation. Any board member questions, comments on my right?
Yeah, thank you. That, to that last, Megan, the status of the RFP, it's been issued, it's been received, it's been evaluated, and
yes.
Are we in this action authorizing approval of a specific contract?
Not a specific contract. You're approving authorization of us to implement the program, which would then we would then enter into a contract with the vendor that we are have tentatively
okay, does that contract
with.
Have to come back to the board for
no
approval?
It does not.
Okay, because we've authorized the
because you'll authorize him to enter into the contract agreement with the person with the vendor.
Okay. Can you identify the vendor at this point?
My safety vendor. Yeah, it's a company called RA United. Mm-hmm. We had multiple different agency or businesses that applied, but they were the most responsive. They had a very, competitive price. Mm-hmm. And the person also had experience doing the identical program with San Joaquin Valley APCD, so we thought that was a great, they already knew what they were getting into.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Supervisor. Board member questions on my left or comments?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I just wonder if there's any prioritization for people living in high dust areas of the county, or if it's just anybody who wants to apply.
For this program, it's anyone that's eligible that wishes to apply. Since we did focus our last program specifically in those regions of with high dust and the Oceano communities and the ones that have the high AQI, we're happy to extend this to all regions of the county.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My other question, excuse me, recovering from a cold here. In terms of the online application, would it be possible to in some way reach out to the libraries that have computers as opposed to asking people to come to headquarters in San Luis Obispo? I'm just concerned that for a lot of people in this income group, doing anything online is a big barrier. But in the libraries, there are librarians who will help you get into it. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's something I could definitely reach out to some of our local libraries.
Yeah, just maybe check it out, because a lot of people, again, in this income group, rely on the computers that are in the libraries when they get to a situation where they have to use one and they don't own one.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we can do that for sure.
Any other board member questions or comments? I'll bring it back for comments, I guess, after public comment. Did you have comments or questions? Question.
Just adding on to the library concept, I was thinking the same thing in regards to the wood burning one, because we really are having a much more robust county library outreach with languages and in areas. So we could probably, I think that they might be able to, I don't know, they've got a lot on their plate, but it's a good question to ask. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, with that, go to public comment. Is there any public comment on this item? Okay, we'll bring it back to the board for comments and or a motion. I do have a couple comments. I guess I'll make those now. I really like the idea of this program being expanded countywide. I like the idea of outreach in coordination with our county libraries, if possible. Same thing with pulmonologists or local pediatricians, mm-hmm. if there is a way to kind of reach out to those folks in mass. Education and outreach is critical. The Spanish and Mixteco translation and outreach is critical. I like the drop shipping approach. I think that's a really wise way to approach this in an efficient manner. In terms of, just low-income residents, I think one of the reasons that this program is important is because a lot of folks wouldn't choose to buy an air purifier and set up their room in this way for a clean room that when faced with having to pay for grocery bills or rent. And so the fact that we're able to do this really does target folks in a way that will, I think, overall reduce impacts to even our healthcare system and future costs if we can bring down rates of asthma, et cetera, into the future. So very supportive of this program. Would somebody like to make a motion?
I thought you eloquently made a motion support of staff's recommendation that I would be proud to second.
Okay, any discussion? And I'll just again thank staff for all the hard work on this. It's nice to see this program evolve over the years. And we've got a motion and a second. Can we get a roll call vote?
The motion was made by you, Director Paulding, and seconded by Director Gibson. Thank
Correct.
You. Director Arnold?
Yes.
Director Bright?
Yes.
Director Darris?
Yes.
Director Hammond?
Aye.
Director Marks?
Yes.
Director Ortiz Legg?
Yes.
Director Pichong?
Yes.
Director Seacrest?
Yes.
Director Wixom?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Paulding?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous.
With that, we'll move on to item D3. That's a spotlight on our compliance program.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Paulding, and good morning to everyone here. It's always nice to get to present to the board. I'm Carl Tupper. As of Monday, I'm a division manager, and I'm here with Tricia Atkins, who's going to also give part of this presentation. So I've been in charge of our compliance program for about the last 3 years now. And so an overview, so compliance, what we do is compliance and enforcement. These are kind of the four or five areas that we focus on. Permit compliance, so making sure that people are, you know, we've given them a permit, now we want to make sure that the permit's followed. We also run the burn program. We investigate and deal with air quality complaints. We have an asbestos program. And then this last part on mutual settlements, I'll talk about, you know, what do we do when we find violations of rules. So real quick, I, of course, am Carl Tupper. I'm the lead of our burn program. Tricia is going to talk about asbestos, and she's the lead on that program, and also oil and gas facilities. Mark Bolianitz, who's not here with us right now, is our gas station lead. We have a position opening up. Charles Cunningham, tomorrow is actually his last day with us, and then we'll be opening a recruitment to replace him. And of course, we get a lot of help from our engineers, Sarah, Dave, division manager Dora Drexler, and also our admin staff. And currently we don't have any interns, but we usually have one or two interns that helps us out with this program as well. And, you know, I've listed kind of our program lead areas, but we all do everything. We all do permit inspections. We all investigate complaints. We are all on the burn program. So permit compliance. So we've got almost 900 facilities in the county under permit. Some facilities have multiple permits. So we've got, as it says here, 1,154 permits or registrations, which are technically not permits, but are very similar to permits. And this encompasses thousands of individual pieces of equipment. And so when we write a permit, you know, there's conditions in that permit that are meant to control air pollutants and, you know, make sure that things are operated in a way that minimizes impacts on the public. And so we need to make sure that those conditions are being followed. And that's kind of the point of our permit compliance program. So every year we're going out and inspecting our permitted facilities. Some facilities receive multiple inspections a year, depending on exactly, you know, the nature of the facility. So last year in 2023, we did almost 1,300 permit inspections. We actually did more total inspections, but just in terms of inspections that are focused on permit compliance, there was this 1,291 last year. So this is everything from our big oil and gas facilities like the refinery, Sentinel Peaks Resources oil field in Price Canyon, and some large facilities like that. We have some chemical manufacturing, waste disposal. So on the right here, we've got a picture of former inspector Anaïs Tournier on top of a landfill checking for methane leaks. On the left is the anaerobic digester by the airport that takes all the green waste from SLO and you know, turns that, digests it and turns it into compost and energy. So that's one of our larger permitted facilities. Every gas station has a permit with us where we're permitting the vapor recovery system to make sure that that's in good working order, and those are visited every year. Lots of larger industrial scale boilers, incinerators, lots of diesel engines, basically any stationary diesel engine that's over 50 horsepower. Should have a permit with us. Also lots of mobile diesel engines. So on the right we have a chipper. Some equipment like this is permitted directly with us, some is permitted with the state. And then things like dry cleaners, automotive spray booths, or any kind of spray booth. We have a lot of those under permit. And so what are we looking for when we do these inspections? Most permits will have some record keeping requirements, so we'll want to, you know, make sure those records are being kept and are up to date. Lots of equipment has throughput limits. So, you know, diesel engines, backup generators are limited to a number of hours they can run every year for maintenance. Other facilities have other types of throughput limits. In some cases, how much gas can they pump in a year? How much certain products can they produce? Things like that. So we're checking on those. When we're on site, we're looking for new equipment that we don't know about or equipment that's been removed that needs to come off the permit, things that have changed. Depending on the equipment, the permit might call out certain temperatures, pressures, voltages, pH, things like that. So we'll be checking on that. And we're also typically checking for visible emissions. Is there smoke coming out of this smokestack? Are there visible leaks? Things of that nature. And so those are the types of things that we do in our permit compliance program. And I would say this is really the heart and soul of enforcement. You know, most of what we do are these types of inspections. working very closely with our engineers as well. The next thing I'll talk about here is our burn program. And there's really three components to that. There's burn day forecasting, issuing burn permits, and then working with agencies like CAL FIRE on prescribed burns. So, you know, here's a picture of Los Osos on a typical day, really beautiful. And then here was in same shot, but in 2020 during the wildfires. And this is what our burn program is designed to try to prevent. You know, we want people to burn, and so that we can reduce fire hazard and prevent the types of wildfires that caused what we see here. But we also want people to burn in a way that, preserves these clean skies, right? When burning is done properly, we can it can usually be done without impacting your neighbors, without degrading the air quality. So the first part of the burn program is burn day determination. In our county, it's us, the Air Pollution Control District, that determines whether it's a permissive burn day or not. And our goal there is to minimize smoke impacts. So in calling a burn day, we're looking for meteorological conditions that, you know, predict good atmospheric dispersion. So the pile gets lit off and the smoke rises up and is dispersed without impacting people on the ground. We also want to see that there hasn't been recent rain, because if burn piles are wet, they're going to be smokier and cause more pollution. And of course, if air quality is already poor because it's, you know, high ozone, or we're getting impacts from wildfires, and we don't want to add to that. So we will call it a no burn day if it's poor air quality. And on the right, we have two burn zones, an inland zone and a coastal zone. You can kind of see the map right there. Every burn permit we issue says right on it what burn zone you're in. And so the burn day decision can be different for the two burn zones, although I would say 99% of the time it's the same for both zones. And then, so where do people find out about this? We have a toll-free number they can call, they can follow us on Twitter, and then on our website, every single web page in the upper left-hand corner has this, what you see here on the lower left there, it says what the burn day status is, coastal and inland. Currently, it's no burn day due to the recent rain that we had, but we anticipate probably on the weekend, you know, lifting that restriction and allowing burning again. So burn permits. So all burning in the county is by permit only, and having a burn permit program allows us to ensure that, you know, people know what the rules are. It allows us to put conditions on burning to ensure that burning is done in a clean and safe way. So our main burn permit types are backyard burns. These are available to residents kind of outside of the cities and built-up areas, so technically outside of the village reserve line, urban reserve line. There must be a residence on the property, and these are $50. And people are only allowed to burn during burn season, which, as Gary mentioned, opened in December and always closes on April 30th. And there's a lot of restrictions on these backyard burn permits, how big the piles can be, what materials can go into them, how far they can be from structures, the times of day that people can burn. But all that's, again, to ensure that burning is done in a way that minimizes impacts. The other big type of burn permit we issue are ag burn permits. These are a lot less restrictive. There has to be some ag use of the property. Ag income has to be derived from the property where the burning is occurring. This can be growing crops. It can also be livestock, things of that nature. Permits $100 is good for a year. And there are restrictions on those permits as well, but they're a lot less restrictive than backyard burning in terms of the piles can be any size. They can light multiple piles off at once. The hours of burning are less restrictive. And so, as I said, ag and backyard burning are the big ones. If people have had one in the past, they can renew online with a credit card. They go to our website, put their credit card number in there, their previous burn permit number, and we can issue that easily online. It's our admin staff that handles 99% of the ag and backyard burning. If people don't renew online, they can get a paper application from our office, the libraries, if we were just talking about libraries, all the libraries in our county have paper applications. People can print one out from our website and mail it in with a check. And then we also issue permits for other types of burning, like large prescribed fires, which I'll talk about next, fire hazard reduction burn permits. Those are free training, you know, firefighter training permits, things like that. And then new this year, CAL FIRE is also requiring a permit for most areas. So anywhere where CAL FIRE is the fire agency that's responsible, oopsie, they are requiring a permit. Their permits are free, and you can go online and fill out a form, and it's emailed to you. So some stats. So current burn season opened on December 4th, and as I mentioned, will close on April 30th. So far in this burn season, so since December 4th, we've issued, or this was actually as of like Friday, we had issued 663 backyard burn permits. And then looking at last year, last burn season, we issued 1,119 backyard burn permits, 567 ag burn permits, and then 45 of these other kind of special permits for prescribed fires and training and stuff like that. And then in 2023, we received 33 complaints that were related to burning, either prescribed fires or, hey, you know, my neighbor's burning, things of that nature. And we issued 5 notices of violation related to our burn program. So things like burning without a permit, burning illegal materials, burning on a no-burn day, that type of stuff. So, I mean, overall, I think we've had, you know, really good compliance, right? We had, you know, almost 2,000 burn permits issued. We only got 33 complaints about burning, and we only issued 5. We only had to issue 5 notices of violation related to burning. So I think overall, the program's working really well, and people are getting the permits they need, and they're abiding by them, and we're able to make this happen without incurring a lot of impacts on bystanders. And then the last element of the burn program is prescribed fire. So these are large prescribed burns, typically multi-agency collaboration. So CAL FIRE, of course, is the big one, Camp Roberts Fire Department, state parks. And so our role in these large prescribed fires is ignition authorization. So we get a yay or nay as to whether or not this fire is gonna happen today, based on meteorology. That's a big one. We also do a lot of media outreach, particularly for the larger burns or burns that are close to sensitive areas. We want people to know that it's happening, right? We want people to be in the loop. So we play, you know, we issue press releases, and, you know, we can send text alerts out to subscribers and things like that. And then the last part of our role in these big fires, these big prescribed burns, is smoke observation. So we'll be out there checking for smoke impacts, and we're in touch with the agency doing the burn. You know, we don't like to do it. It doesn't happen very often, but we, you know, can say, hey, you know, it's getting a little smoky. Can we take a break on ignition and let it clear out and maybe try again in a little while? And we, you know, again, we don't like to do that, but we have done that on occasion. So just as an example, every year there's the Camp Roberts, what we call the impact burn. This is basically their firing range. It's 9,000 acres. There's lots of live ordnance. There's no way to get in there and do any fuel reduction besides burning because it's too dangerous. And so every year this burn happens. It's actually mostly, it kind of straddles the Monterey County, SLO County line, but just the way the winds are, this all the smoke comes into our county. And so last year this happened on June 1st. It was a multi-agency collaboration with CAL FIRE, Camp Roberts, ourselves, and the Monterey Air District. And it was successful. They were able to achieve their goals of fuel reduction and firefighter training, and it happened with no complaints because, you know, it was able to happen under conditions where the smoke rose out and was dispersed. And, you know, we have several large prescribed fires in our county this year, the most recent one Gary mentioned in his APCO report being the Lighthouse Fire in Avila Beach. And now I'm going to hand it over to Tricia, who's going to talk about our asbestos program.
Yeah, it's this way.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair Paulding and the board. As Carl said, my name is Tricia Atkins, and I'm an air quality specialist with the district, and I am the asbestos program lead. This slide shows the EPA webpage for the asbestos NESHAP program, and we enforce the federal law. And this webpage is a very good resource for us as a regulatory agency. It provides a lot of links, a lot of guidance, and we can, besides our own webpage for asbestos NESHAP, we can direct contractors and the public to not just our webpage, but to this webpage directly. And even though we know the dangers of asbestos, why is it used? And this slide shows, provides very good reasons of the quality of asbestos and why it's used and why it still actually continues to be used. Because asbestos is a hazardous pollutant and it is a known carcinogen. But because of these qualities, it persists today and is still included in many construction materials. And so that is why we enforce the asbestos NESHAP program. So this is a very good diagram of a house that shows very typical construction materials that asbestos could potentially be in. And one reason why our program is very important is because you can have a house or a structure built today, and it, you know, there's a very high percentage that possibility that there will be asbestos-containing materials, because a lot of the construction materials are imported, and there's a misconception that asbestos is just like lead paint, which was banned in paint in 1978. So there's a very hard date there. But it's not that with asbestos, but it's a very common misconception, even with contractors. People think the house is older. It was built after 1978 or in the 1990s when the rule came out, 40 CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 61, and then Subpart M, which is specific to asbestos. But that's not the case, and so we employ a lot of education and outreach to our the building departments in the cities and the county. We've put together, or our former colleague Anais and Carissa put together a really great PowerPoint presentation for our planning departments around the county, for them to become partners with us. So contractors and homeowners know to contact us, and we can advise them and provide guidance on how they need to comply with the regulations, and so they don't get in trouble with us, and that they conduct have a asbestos survey conducted by a certified asbestos consultant, because it has to be California certified, and then they may be necessary depending on the survey, and if it's just a renovation, if they need to then submit a notification to us. So this outreach is ongoing, and we've revamped our webpage. We've updated guidance documents specific to renovation and to demolitions, and we're always available to answer questions. So, you know, why is asbestos hazardous, and why do we desire to do this ongoing education? It's because, as I said, it's a known carcinogen, and you know it's takes many years, decades, for the effects to be felt by the person. And unfortunately, that's usually right around when you retire and you want to enjoy, you know, your deserved retirement after working hard, and then you may be diagnosed with this. You know, we have a staff member whose father-in-law was diagnosed with mesothelioma. So, I mean, it is a real issue. And I just also wanted to bring up, I don't know if everybody remembered, in February of last year, there was that devastating earthquake that happened in Turkey and Syria. And there's a lot of information online. It's not just the earthquake that killed many people and brought devastation, but they are also looking at, in decades to come, that it's going to be, like, there's going to be a lost generation because there is so much asbestos dust, and the government is actually denying that. And so there could be, there probably will be significant health issues in Turkey and Syria in the next 40 years, you know, with children are playing in the rubble. So it's very sad. So where do we get our authority? So the National Emission Standards for Hazardous Air Pollutants, which was came out of the Clean Air Act, Part 112. Asbestos is one of those pollutants, and that, again, is we find those regulations set out in 40 CFR Part 61, Subpart M. There's other subparts, but M is specific to asbestos. And so, and that it applies to renovations and demolitions of regulated structures. And the other authority we have listed here, the asbestos ATCM for construction, grading, quarrying, and surface mining operations, applies to the naturally occurring asbestos, NOAA. And we certainly have quite a zone here locally in the county. So we have authority there to require entities who are going to be doing development in these areas to submit an exemption application to us, or they might need to submit a dust mitigation plan. And so what is the NESHAP? You know, it's the federal regulation that covers regulated asbestos-containing material. And renovations larger than 160 square feet or 260 linear feet, and then demolitions regardless of the size. And so the RACM is really what we're looking at. And so for projects of regulated structures where they're going to do a renovation or I'll focus on renovation right now. If there is RACM, which the survey will point out, and that is asbestos, like there's 1% of asbestos and it's friable, meaning you can crush it with your hand. And so it presents that much more of a risk. And it's a renovation and it's larger than 160 square feet or 260 linear feet, then it is subject to the regulations, and we require the survey plus the NESHAP notification to be submitted to us. For demolitions of a regulated structure, even if the survey shows there's no RACM, they still are required to submit the survey and the notification to the district, and then we evaluate that. The NESHAP, though, does not cover single-family residences or complexes that have four or less dwelling units, and that's apartments, townhouses, or, like, say, condos. However, there are exemptions. There are some single-family residences that are not exempt, and these would be a structure that is being demolished, say, for a training burn, or that it was a single-family residence, but then it was turned into, say, like a lawyer's office or a doctor's office. And then that subject, and even if it reverted back to being a single-family residence, the federal law states that it will always be held to this regulation. They will never be exempt. Or if it's a government-owned structure, residential structure part of public housing, or you have two residential structures, say a house and a garage or a house and an ADU, and they're going to be both renovated and under one project, they are not exempt. So this is our application form. And it's online, and we also have an explanation of the form and what's required to be completed, and plus the survey conducted by a certified asbestos consultant. And so we review this to make sure it's complete. And we're also looking for that it's submitted at the minimum 10 days prior to any work being done, like if they need an asbestos abatement, because that provides the district time to send staff to go out and inspect. And then if we, when we go out and do inspections, we're looking to make sure that it's properly sealed off. And so the work being done, everything stays inside. It doesn't become a public health risk. That the material that they remove is kept wet. And that, you know, what they're doing matches what they notified us that they were doing. We look at how they're bagging up the waste, the asbestos waste, that it's, you know, properly sealed, labeled, and will be disposed of, and they have to put that on the form of, you know, where they're actually taking it, and we can look that up to make sure that this is a facility that will accept the asbestos waste and make sure that they're not tracking asbestos all over the place, you know, which can happen. And so these are some of the common issues we find when we're reviewing survey these notifications that actually this would be more of us actually driving around the very first one, no survey or notification, you know, staff, or we get a call from a citizen about a project, we look it up in our database, we don't have a notification, we know it's a regulated structure, and we go by, and the first thing we'll ask for is, do you have your survey? And, you know, if they don't, then they'll have to immediately stop, get a survey done, and then, if necessary, submit the notification. Or the survey is incomplete, and then we'll provide them guidance on what makes up a complete survey, which is also on our website. The notification is not complete, or we've done an inspection and we have found violations. And so in the first instance, the no survey notification, and then in the last inspection violations, those would most likely result in enforcement actions, and then Carl will go over those. And that's it for my presentation. Thank you.
I just, if the board would like, we could split this in half for another time period, or if you want to carry on for the remainder.
How much longer is the presentation if we...
5 or 10 minutes.
5, 10. If we can get it to 5, is the board okay with that?
It'll be 2.
Okay. I think we would appreciate that. If just an expedited 5. Presentation would be great.
Sure, I can zip through.
Yeah.
So another big area we have is complaints. You know, we take calls about typically air pollution complaints. It ends up being a lot of odor complaints and smoke complaints. People can call them in. We have an email address. We sometimes get them through the mail or referral from outside agency. Complainants remain anonymous. We don't disclose their names to the parties that they're complaining about or to anybody else. 2023, we had 41 odor complaints, another 41 that related to smoke or burning. This could be like a, you know, smoke coming out of a stack or something like that, or a wildfire. We get dust complaints and lots of just miscellaneous type of stuff. We investigate all complaints. Active complaints are prioritized. If someone calls up and is saying, hey, right now, this is happening, we make sure someone gets out there and investigates that. And so lots of education. Sometimes we refer things to other agencies. And when necessary, when we find violations of rules, we can take enforcement action. So speaking of enforcement action, what do we do when we see noncompliance? So this could be we're out on an inspection of a permitted facility. They're not keeping records properly. They're over a throughput limit. They failed an emissions test. We're driving around. We see a structure that's being demolished. We don't have a notification of NESHAP, a NESHAP notification. There's a burn. We find someone who's burning without a permit or burning on a no-burn day. What do we do? Our options here, we have a number of options. In some cases, there's no formal enforcement action. We can just kind of work with the facility to bring them back into compliance. The next step would be a notice to comply, which is sort of like a fix-it ticket. There's no penalty, but it says, you know, you need to fix this by this date or else, you know, we kind of ramp things up. We can issue notices to apply, which is when we find equipment that should be permitted but is not. We can issue them a notice to apply, and then they have to apply and get a permit. And then lastly, we have our notices of violation, which typically involve paying a civil penalty and also certain conditions that ensure that they come into compliance. And the goal is always to return people to compliance and then to ensure continued compliance. So maximum penalties per the health and safety code are you know, can be quite large, $5,800 per day for sort of more minor violations, and it goes up from there, and these are adjusted every year for inflation. So these will actually go up pretty soon. I think the memo's coming out next month from CARB. So we like to settle, we rarely go after maximum penalties. It's advantageous for us to reach an agreement with the violator where typically they're gonna pay a civil penalty, but it's not gonna be anywhere near these maximum penalties, and they're gonna be required to come into compliance. But we can do this with an agreement rather than having to go through the court process. And it saves everybody a lot of time and money, including us. And so our settlement structures, as I said, there's a civil penalty, which is designed to dissuade future violations and disincentivize noncompliance. We don't want it to be cheaper for people to pay penalties than to do the right thing, right? And then a compliance plan to bring people into compliance. And when we calculate penalties by state law, we have to take into account these things here: the type of violation, how severe it was, the facility's history of compliance, have they had lots of violations in the past, did they correct the problem promptly? Did they maybe even self-report the problem? That's always good, right? Economic benefit, if, again, we don't want it to be cheaper for people to sit around and pay penalties than it is for them to, you know, install pollution controls or do the right thing. And then lastly, financial burden, right? A small penalty might be more than adequate to, you know, disincentivize noncompliance to our small business, right? But for a larger business, you know, like the refinery or, you know, a large corporate facility, you know, a larger penalty might be more appropriate. So just some examples. For a failed emission test on some boilers, we found that they were in violation of their emissions limits for more than 72 days. It was the second time they'd had a violation like this in the last 3 years, and it was their fourth violation in the last 5 years. And the previous notice of violation was settled for $20,000. So our proposed settlement, which they accepted, was to pay a civil penalty of $22,000, or $22,800, and a compliance plan where basically we just had them put signs up that said, hey, make sure when this boiler is tuned, it meets these emission standards, or it meets these, yeah, the emissions are below these levels. Some other examples, burning without a permit. This is what we call strict liability, and it was typically a $500 penalty. You know, you burn without a permit, maybe you didn't even know you needed a permit, but it happened. You didn't mean to break the rules, but it happened. It's a typically we settle these for a $500 penalty and require that they apply for a permit in the future. And then the last one I'll mention is we had a coffee roaster who was not using their afterburner, and it was sort of just an oversight. It had gotten turned off. They didn't even know they weren't using their afterburner. We initially offered to settle that for $500. They said, hey, you know, this is kind of an economic hardship for us. So we ended up settling for $250 and a compliance plan that requires them to put a sign in view of the operator that says, make sure the afterburner is on, and then also to do some employee education to, again, ensure that their operators are know about the afterburner and that it needs to be on. And that's about it. Just to summarize, including all inspection types, we did 1,369 inspections in 2023. We fielded 131 complaints. We issued almost 2,000 burn permits. We had 50 NOVs. 18 notices to comply and 14 notices to apply, and we collected $62,000 in penalties. And so that, you know, compared to our annual budget, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. We don't rely on revenue from penalties, you know, to meet our budget. And that's about it. I'm happy to answer any questions. Tricia can answer questions. There she is. About asbestos stuff.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Tricia, and congratulations on the promotion.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments from members of the board?
I just had a quick comment. And Carl, I appreciate you bringing up that new on the ag burn permit that Cal Fire is now requiring, because both of us attend regularly the Fire Safe and so forth. And I don't think that's been publicized very well. Or, I mean, I don't think a lot of people know about it.
Yeah, yet. I mean, it hasn't been publicized super well.
Started, for sure. But I appreciate you mentioning it today. And also, Patricia, thank you for all that information. Yep.
Director Hammond?
Thanks, Chair. The CAL FIRE, I'm concerned or kind of curious about the CAL FIRE fuel reduction and prescribed burns. Do they often tell you what they want to try and do? And I mean, in other words, particularly, I know they've been working around the city and where it can be burning into a city, that kind of a thing. And they'd like to do as much as they can, but are we allowing them only so much, or is that their recommendation that they want to do an X amount of projects, so to speak, at a time?
Yeah, so they will submit what we call a smoke management plan for us to review and approve.
Right.
And so, you know, as far as like where they think the fuel reduction projects need to happen and how big they are, I mean, that's up to them.
No. That's their thing. You're going to control the time and place because of the environmental kind of conditions.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, they're professionals. They kind of know what atmospheric conditions need to be to accomplish the burn in a way that's going to minimize smoke impact. So our role is really oversight. You know, we just kind of make sure that, yep, we agree these are good conditions, and yes, we agree that, like, you know, on this day when you're planning to do it, that the prescription is met, and it should be able to happen without impacting the public.
Okay, and then the final question, Kurt, is where you have the city or agency that has a basically no burn policy, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
When you have some sort of a vineyard or some sort of a agricultural concern within that area, are they allowed to do permits if they request it directly from APCD?
We're aware of all the municipalities and CSDs burn restrictions, and so, you know, the APCD local rule might say ag burning can take place anywhere in the county, but like Paso Robles does not allow burning within the city. So we would not issue an ag burn permit within
over the
city.
Top of another agency.
Right. Yeah. We're trying to coordinate everything. We do have the option of what's called a fire hazard reduction permit, which if the local fire agency, Paso Robles Fire, Cal Fire, says there's a fire hazard here, and you know, if they're willing to make that determination, then we can issue a burn permit, and those are actually free. There's no charge to the property owner.
And the last thing, being on the fire for almost 20 years, fire department, you know, training burns are really, really important to new firefighters. I've never been into a structure that's really on fire, and we usually do those inside a city limit. So are we allowing that still on occasion?
Yeah, training burns are allowed. they require a permit from us. And again, we recognize the value of that, and we just kind of want to make sure they're done in a way that minimizes impacts to the public. So we do attach some conditions to those burns. It's a lot of stuff about notification, just to make sure that everyone's in the loop.
And removal of the asbestos materials.
Right.
As well.
It's got to be mitigated first before they burn it.
Yeah.
But,
burn, you know, people, fire agencies want to train, they want to burn cars, and that's understandable. But like, we don't want people burning cars with tires on them in the middle of a city, right? You know, so things like that.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, Kurt.
Mm-hmm. And I can attest to the fact that we do allow the trained burns with Cal Fire. They let me participate in one, suited up, went into the building. It was hot, let me tell you. Anyhow, Director Marks.
Thank you. I have a question for Patricia, I think. Is there any kind of duty to disclose the amount of asbestos that is in new construction? Like, there's a lot of new construction in the city of San Luis Obispo, and I didn't realize till I heard your talk that there probably is asbestos being included in that construction. Is there any duty to disclose to someone who might be purchasing a home about the amount of asbestos that's being used in the construction?
Not that I'm aware of. I know because I have an old house here in town. You get for lead paint, there's like the blue pamphlet that you get that advises you of the hazards. But no, I'm not aware of any duty to inform you. I would definitely, older homes would have it. And I would be, more concerned about that. Mm-hmm.
There's not too much asbestos in the newer materials, but they're just not prohibited from it.
Right.
So it's very likely you have very little in your new dwellings. But there's no provision that says carte blanche there can't be any asbestos in materials. Okay. Certain materials, yes. And the federal government is going towards that ban of that, but it's not there yet.
Not there yet, yeah. They are trying to update right now the EPA, but it's only for specific asbestos-containing material like brake pads and linings. And then apparently in water systems, there is this permeable layer that may have asbestos, and they're looking to prohibit that use. And and so they took public comment last year on this, and so we might see some new rulemaking on those specific items, but not construction materials.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions, comments from the board? Seeing none, any members of the public have public comment? Seeing none, with that, this is a receive and file. I will move that we receive and file this report. Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, with that, any board member items? Seeing none, we will move to adjourn the meeting, and our next meeting is scheduled for May 15th of this year. Everybody have a good day.